morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, the Black Arts and Culture Program of the African Sisters Media Network. We are going to rebroadcast an interview from Friday, May 16th with Michael Lange and Crescenda Jenkins. They are speaking about the expulsion of Malcolm X, Larry Emmerich Allen's riveting play, which is at Laney College through this weekend. Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. This is Malcolm X weekend. We want to wish him a happy birthday. And we have on the show as our first guest Michael Lange, who is actor, director, and filmmaker, and Crescenda Jenkins. And both of them on the air to talk about this really wonderful encore production of The Expulsion of Malcolm X, a wonderful play that had a wonderful run in San Francisco, and now it's going to be in the East Bay at Laney College starting May 23rd. Is that right, Michael?
That's correct. Yes, it is.
Yeah. So before I read your bios, why don't we talk a little bit about Brother Malcolm, as he is affectionately known. And what birthday would it be for him? His birthday is actually May 19th, but in the throughout the community college district, and I think it's kind of unprecedented, Malcolm X's birthday is honored by the entire throughout the community college district closing. So today, the 16th, is the day that is Malcolm X Day in the Peralta Community College District and the day that people are home and not working. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about Brother Malcolm, Michael, since you are, besides being an actor, director, filmmaker, best known for your portrayal of Malcolm X, Alistair Willis specifically. And it's so interesting, like in this play, instead of playing Brother Malcolm and directing as you did for the play's world premiere, you actually are playing Elijah Muhammad, Brother Malcolm's mentor, and almost served as like a father figure for him.
Yes, well, Brother Malcolm would be 89. So he was born on May 19th, of course, in 1925. That's actually the same year my mother was born, and she's 89, so that way I can keep up with Brother Malcolm. I have had a few people who had the same birthday that will come on Monday, certainly at different ages, but I'm always resonating with people who are in the month of May, particularly around Malcolm. But I've had the pleasure of traveling across this nation, been in many states portraying Malcolm X and doing what they would call delineation, the cadence of Malcolm X, his ballot or the bullet speech, and his message to the grassroots. And I've done them probably somewhere between 800 and 1,000 times. And usually just on weekends, flying around different parts, New York City, and I've been to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and upstate Seattle, Washington, and down south in Atlanta. So I've seen the, I remember I started in 1990, so I started prior to Spike Lee's film, and as I started getting more and more opportunities to perform, the film came out, and certainly by 1993, I think the film came out, I was really riding the crest of the public sentiment. They were saying, wow, this is really good. And it was a fad of a sort in that what was happening is the X clothing, everybody would come to a performance similar here to the Paramount Theater, but this was in Greensboro, North Carolina. It was amazing to see this. And then about 6 or 7 months later, the clothing just disappeared out of a lot of the performances that I was in. So I've had a good run. I think it would be 24 years I've been doing Malcolm. And finally, at age 65, and certainly Malcolm passed away at age 39, it was time for me to step aside and to allow a young man, his name is DeJuan Connor, and he stepped into the shoes, and he was doing a tremendous job. The vitality, the energy, the cadence, the mannerisms that he brings as Malcolm X just delights me, and I feel good. And he had asked if I would play the mentor to Malcolm X, Elijah Muhammad. So I said, yes, I would.
Wow. Yeah, I know when I first met you a long time ago, you were doing, Brother Malcolm or Hajj Malik El Shabazz as, you know, a one-man performance. And then
Yes. Later
on I saw you and James. What's James's last name?
Brooks. James Brooks.
James Brooks. Yeah, you all would do the meeting, which is, you know, the fictional meeting between Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr., and that's a really wonderful piece. And who's the writer, the playwright for that particular piece?
That's Jeff Stetson. He's a playwright in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. Right,
very,
yeah.
Very, very fine writer. I don't know how he would. I would only want to do verbatim educational things, and somebody brought me the script, the meeting. And I said, well, is this true? And he says, no, it's not. It's a fictionalized meeting between Dr. King and Malcolm. So I said, well, I'd like to do what really was stated in history. And when I read the play, though, I couldn't believe how much history this writer had captured of both Malcolm X and Martin, and then put it into a conversation between the two as if it actually took place. So I've done that quite a bit around the country, beginning in 1997, right up until, probably up until about a year ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And another historic character you've portrayed a lot, you and James, again, that wonderful collaboration of black men, actors, directors here in the San Francisco Bay Area, was the one on Frederick Douglass. And then, you know, doing the What to an American Slave is the 4th of July at Angela Wellman's
the Music Academy,
Yes, exactly. And that, you know, like you just start these things and they just become, you know, sort of annual rituals, so to speak, you know, in honoring our ancestors. And so with The Expulsion of Malcolm X, written by Larry Amrick Allen and directed by you, which begins on Friday, May 23rd at 7:30, is the East Bay premiere, at Laney College Theater, 900 Fallon Street. And it continues Saturday the 24th, 7:30, Thursday, May 29th at 7:30, Friday the 30th, and then Saturday and Sunday the 31st. It has two performances at 2:30 and 7:30, and that's going to be really exciting.
Yeah, there won't be any Sunday performances, but there will be two on Saturday. The 20th,
right.
The 31st, May 31st.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll really be digging down to get that energy to get those two performances on the same day. It's a classic play. It's probably 2.5 hours. So when you add a 15-minute intermission, It almost is about 3 hours. It's about 3 hours and 2 or 3 minutes. And it's a beautiful production, and we will have a folk talk where we will give Q&A with the actors and the playwright at the Saturday 2:30 matinee performance.
Mm-hmm. So that'll be both on the 24th and the 31st?
That will only be on the 31st.
Oh, okay.
Because that's an afternoon. We would be at Laney until midnight if we did it on the 24th, because we start at 7:30. We'll probably get out about, say, 10:30, and that's pretty late at night. So we did want to have a Q&A period, so we'll have it on the 31st.
Okay, excellent. And so for those who saw the world premiere, we probably caught Crescenda Jenkins portraying Betty X, but if you missed her, you have an opportunity to see her again. So Crescenda, you describe yourself as a thespian at heart, and that you've always had a passion for performing arts. You started acting on stage at the age of 15, and although you took a hiatus for some time, you're back and ready to play again your role as Sister Betty. And
yeah.
In The Expulsion of Malcolm X. And so why don't you tell us about Sister Betty, as well as about this play, which is, I believe, it's epic, because there, you know, Ambrick is such a fine writer, and he just puts so much history. It's so dense. But your Sister Betty is like, oh, my God. I mean, people know Sister Betty Shabazz, you know, Malcolm X's partner, was a phenomenal woman. However, we don't really know how phenomenal she is until you sort of, you know, breathe life into this character and perform, you know, this particular role in a way that people are like sitting back like, wow, oh, my goodness, this woman, like, so wonder, you know, Haj Malik chose her as his life partner.
I really love her. I love the being of Betty Shabazz, Betty X. She was, not only was Malcolm prolific, she was in her own right. She was a strength, a silent strength during his time. And then after his death, she became very vocal. And you were able to see the strength of this being and to see why they were such a team. And it was, I tell people this all the time, that it was hard to, it's hard to play her role, to feel the emotion, or the at least the emotion that I feel that she felt being his wife. Because there was always a fear that he may pass, you know. And when it happened, oh, I could just imagine the pain that she went through. But she's a beautiful being. She ended up raising all her children on her own. And she was so intelligent and had so much passion for his struggle. So I just feel very privileged to be able to play this role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so how did you come to be cast in this particular role?
I went out and I auditioned, and luckily I got the role.
I remember her audition. She was bringing, I guess it's the it factor, they call it now, but she's bringing an energy of vitality. And that's why when she mentioned she was a thespian, I mean, that she truly goes into the emotion and the passion and then the intelligence, all of that is in the mix. And she clearly stood out among the other people who were auditioning that day. And so I was happy that she said, yes, I'd like to be in the production when we offered her that role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was a blessing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
To
and
be
Michael,
able to have the team.
Yeah, yeah. And so, Michael, you you know, you mentioned, you know, that you've been performing the role of Malcolm X for, gosh, I mean, that's going back, you said...
1990.
Yeah, 1990. That's a long time. And
it was,
you
it
know,
was
have...
May 19th. It was May 19th. It was on Malcolm's birthday,
really?
That I first performed.
Oh, amazing. Wow, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's just... And you've... you know, it's like that is just amazing. And then, you know, we already mentioned, you know, the play that you and James Brooks performed in, but you've also directed two award-winning plays, Ceremonies and Dark Old Men, which received the Best Play Award, and The Old Settler, where you received Best Director. And you premiered Ed Ballou's work, Another Depression, in the role of the human isotope in 2010. And you wrote the play Prophet Nat, and I remember that. That had a wonderful Oakland, California world premiere, and that was really phenomenal. It's a musical musical docudrama based on the life of the slave, formerly enslaved Prophet Nat Turner. Actually, I think he was still enslaved when he was still enslaved when he led the rebellion. And now you're on the faculty at San Jose State University, where you've taught since 1998, and you continue to write and perform for stage and film, and you live in Oakland. I was wondering, Michael, if you could talk, and also you, Crescenda, if you could talk about, you know, some of your favorite, favorite scenes or lines or aspects of the play. But Michael, why don't you talk about sort of, you know, embodying Elijah Muhammad? How is that? How's that coming along?
He does an awesome job, by the way.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Crescenda. That role of Elijah is probably opposite of Malcolm, meaning the amount of power, the cadence, the charisma of a Malcolm X. It was obvious that he had these incredible ideas. His mind, you could see as Malcolm, it was just going so fast, and he would look at his audience, and he would tell that audience wherever it was, whether it was outdoors in New York, in Harlem, or whether it was at the at Harvard University, he would look to see who was out there, and somehow he could dial you up and tell you exactly what you needed to hear. With Elijah, it's actually a different cadence, and it's a timing where he had asthma. He was sickly. He was soft-spoken. He had a third-grade education. So it's the opposite of what I think Malcolm was doing. That's what I'm finding. So the actor's job is to find the melody, the comfort zone, and the rhythm of the character. And I have to go in, which I did as Malcolm. I went in as Michael in search of Malcolm. My director, her name was Gloria Weinstock. She told me, she says, don't bring me Malcolm. And this was in the play, The Meeting. She says, you bring me Michael. And that's how we will find Malcolm. I said, wow, that was a circuit that she knew about. So with Elijah, who has dialogue with other characters and is not just standing at a podium, and speaking to an audience, he's speaking to other members of the Food of Islam. He's interacting with his son, Wallace Muhammad. So now I have to go into ensemble with a kind of a humility, and the way people speak in the South back in the 30s and the 20s when Elijah was a young man, and coming into the 60s, he's 65 years old. I'm 65 years old, so anyway, all I have to do now is just study this man's life and find out how I can bring sincerity and integrity to a life that he lived. And that's what I did with Malcolm X. And so I'm starting to dial him up, still have some rough edges to polish, but I will, once I get that, you know, the clothing on, the lights are up, and the moment of truth shows up on stage, that's when I think I will find Elijah. And he may be different nights, too, I mean, because I'm rehearsing with myself right now, and I'm saying, wow, that was different than what I did last week. So he is evolving, and I don't know where he's going, but I'm going to try to stay up with him and just bring honor to his role. He had a tough, what they call a tough row to hoe. He had to make some moves, and one of the big things was his extramarital affairs, which became known in the press, but not that well known, and he had these other children, and I said, well, why would he do that? And it was really, to me, the next generation of Muhammad. See, his wife could not bring him children. At age, she was probably 63 or 64, somewhere in there. So he had these other children, and these children are alive today. And so I wanted to bring all of this mix into the theatrical piece that Amrick originally intended. And I think Amrick is happy with the interpretation, but I still see a whole lot more in terms of exploration of that particular character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Crescenda, why don't you talk about, I mean, there are a lot of dynamics happening in this particular piece, The Expulsion, and why don't you talk about some of the real tense or intense moments in the piece, you know, with your role as Sister Betty, and what you see, you know, your partner experiencing with regards to, you know, his development as a Muslim, and not necessarily a student of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, you know, as you know, Brother Malcolm sort of grows in his understanding of what it means to be a Muslim and what it means to be a black leader and what it means to be a revolutionary, and also sort of his commitment to his family and you know, his wife and his child, and or children, and then his siblings, his brother who brought him into the Nation of Islam, and that tension there, and then, you know, sort of his ethical and his moral values and how that's being challenged, you know, and, you know, sort of like there's a whole lot of happening in that household.
Yeah.
And it seems like, and your particular character, which is really different, it wasn't in the movie, how, you know, you drop out hints to Brother Malcolm, the character, and he listens to you.
Mm-hmm. It, first Amory wrote a beautiful piece. It's a masterpiece. And the beauty is that, you know, there are all these internal struggles that we're all going through. And for Malcolm, my husband, it's the fact that he, in so many ways, adores Mr. Muhammad, and he has so much loyalty to him that there's so many signs that he's, that, and he doesn't, he's not paying attention to the signs because he doesn't want to believe them. And for me, being his wife and the one who loves him, I try to give him these signs and try to tell him about what's going on. And at first, he doesn't want to listen because he's developing as a world leader. He's developing in his religion. And he just hearing this at this moment or hearing that at that moment would just be so hurtful to him, and so that's one of the biggest intense moments to me in the scenes, I mean in the play, is when I finally just tell him, you know, something is going on, you have to pay attention to what you're listening to, what you're seeing, listen to the signs, you have to pay attention, and that's what makes him go a little further to do some more research, and that's when he finds out the truth, and it hurts him to his heart, because what he finds out is something that, you know, I don't want to tell too much of the play, but what he finds out is something that affects him because it ties back to what happened with him and his brother and the decision that he had to, you know, decide with his brother. So one of my favorite lines in the play is pain is private, because Betty is going through her own internal pain. She doesn't articulate that pain because she wants to be strong. But her fear of losing her husband, her fear with the death threats, her fear with him being in the limelight, she goes through her own internal struggle. So it's a beautiful work of art, and we have so many gems in it. So I'm very excited about it being performed again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Michael, parts of the play, you don't have to necessarily be in them, or pieces or parts that are really difficult to be in or to direct?
Yeah, well, as a director of the last year's world premiere and now being in this production, we realized early on that I needed a director for me as Elijah. And that's not, you know, strange or anything else. It's you realize that you're wearing two hats. And so I'm fortunate to have Gerald Wright and Larry Amrick Allen to help me in this role. And they take on the other parts of the cast when I'm in a scene. So we're doing it by committee practically this way, and it really helps because the amount of, I wouldn't say it was pressure, but it's the intensity of the moments, being in character. How do you get out of that character and then become the director? So what I do at the end, of course, is I collect my thoughts for notes to the actors. And, you know, the other day I wrote a little note to everybody, you know, as a director. And so the big thing is for me to get the character. The play can stand on its own. I mean, even if we sat in the round, what we call a read-through, and we just read this with our memorizing our lines, it would still have an impact. But now we're putting the clothing on, we're putting it on its legs, and then we have different scenes in Harlem, New York, or in Chicago. And so what I need is somebody to give me some feedback in terms of, no, you may want to look at this. And so Amrick has really keyed in. He wrote this play in 1985, he's seeing some nuances now, some for the first time, that he originally intended in 1985 when he wrote it. And these little things smoothed out in relationship to this charismatic Malcolm and to Wallace Muhammad begin to make this play stand for, you know, it's been, what, 30 years right now. It could go another 30 or 40 years, which is the test of a playwright in terms of a classic. Can it make it to 50 years, or is the theme so temporal that it could only last for a season or for 2 or 3 years? So I'm fortunate to have that. There are many great lines in this production. Even the throwaway lines have tremendous impact. There's a scene where Elijah is telling Malcolm that he is his best friend. And it may seem insignificant, but when you see this conspiracy developing around Malcolm by the Nation of Islam trying to find a reason to expel Malcolm out of the nation, and the reason that they gave was this chicken's coming home to roost. And we see this interchange between Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad, where Elijah is like his father, like Malcolm's father, and he tells him, you know, yes, I am your best friend. And what that signaled to me, that even through the expulsion of Malcolm X, that Elijah still loved Malcolm as a son, and probably more, loved him more than his own sons. And he says as much in one of the soliloquies or one of the monologues that Elijah has. It's just a tremendous thing. So I could go into any character, Wallace Muhammad confronting his father with this hypocrite stuff that Elijah has been doing. And Elijah challenges his son. He says, what did you mean about that hypocrite stuff? And Wallace turns to him. He says, what did you think I meant? And it's just powerful. Bottom lines, you know, this is the payoff line or the money lines. There are many, many of them. And the way Amrick wrote it, I think he gives every character a moment on stage where they get a chance to push their craft or to shape it and to be part of a larger wheel. So we bring our little spokes into the bigger wheel, and then what we see is the entire car or the entire wheel as it rolls through Laney College as a kind of a metaphor.
Yeah, I was just wondering if both of you, sort of in our closing minutes, could talk about sort of the relevance of Malcolm X. You say that that he will be, his birthday anniversary, he would have been 90. 89. Yeah, next year will be 90th. Birthday anniversary, and Malcolm X, you know, he was a part of the civil rights movement, and you think about, you know, sort of key iconic figures during that period that, you know, sort of came in, you know, sort of like a comet, and just lit up everything, and then, you know, like comets, their effect lingers because you see the tail, but they're gone. And of all of the, like you think about Elijah, I mean, you think about Martin Luther King Jr., you know, another brilliant man who was, you know, killed at 39. Malcolm X has like an international reputation that, you know, the young folks are still talking about. You know, they're still wearing T-shirts. You know, you travel around the world, and they remember Brother Malcolm. So what is it about Malcolm X that resonates, you know, so powerfully with today's youth, presently, you know, in this country and elsewhere? What is it about him that has that impact? I mean, quite a few things about him, you know, you could mention, but what would you like to mention?
Well, I'd like to mention Malcolm was the people's champion. It's kind of like Muhammad Ali, the boxer, transcends boxing, and he goes into the world community. And people felt an energy out of Malcolm, and that energy was probably his sincerity and his truth. And that's what shows up for a lot of people, even today, more so There's been more books written on Malcolm X 25 years after his death than there were in the first, say, 20 years of his death. So that tells you something, that he is resonating in the world community. And he's looked upon as a Pan-Africanist, a black nationalist, a Muslim. And talking to Atala Shabazz, she says, and I see him as my father. And a lot of people miss that. She witnessed him being assassinated at the Audubon Ballroom at 6 years old, and so she saw her daddy being killed. So that whole civil rights stuff, that matrix going into that, and I lived through it. I was about 16 years old when Malcolm X was assassinated, and 19 when Dr. King was assassinated. So I lived through that. But Malcolm X was after a truth, and that's what transcends the Nation of Islam and Malcolm's life. He was after the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth with his life. And what Amr did is he caught it almost in a Shakespearean format, because the lines are so tremendous. And that's how I see Malcolm X and what this play means today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Krishinda, your comments.
For me, I'm in love with Malcolm X. And I think that the older I've gotten, because when I was younger, of course, when you're in school, you don't get as much knowledge about Malcolm X until you get, you know, older and you are able to research it on your own. And I love his authenticity, and he loved black people. He loved our struggle, and he loved it.
That was Krishinda Jenkins, who's speaking about Malcolm X and her role as Sister Betty X. Both she and Michael Lange were interviewed on my Friday, May 16th show. If you want to catch the end of that, you just go visit the archives, and you can listen to any previously broadcast show going back to 2008. We are joined in the studio by another author, and his first book, Broken Gourds, was just so wonderful. I just loved reading it. Boris Ford McLean, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Wanda. I'm fine.
I had your name better yesterday. I think I killed it this morning. did I do it too badly, or is it close to the correct pronunciation?
You're close enough.
Close enough. You would know that I was calling if you heard me out in the street.
Well, I'd say perhaps leave it alone for a while.
Okay. Barris Ford, is that better?
Yes.
Okay.
So totally forgiven.
Yeah. So you're an author and playwright. You're born in Western St. Mary, Jamaica. You attended and taught high school in Kingston. I've been to Kingston. In 1970, you immigrated to the United States, where you studied physics and subsequently worked in engineering. Your current focus is writing, which is awesome. So are you being able to just write? You don't have to tear yourself away from your muse when she or he hits you?
Writing and then walking. So, yes, I'm free to write as much as I like right now. I've sort of structured my life around writing and then walking, which is my second great passion.
Nice, nice. That's excellent. Yeah. So Broken Gourds is your first inspirational folklore book, and it was published to great acclaim in 2003. We're going to talk about that, as well as your second novel, Providence Pond, which came 3 years later. And your third novel, Fish Hook River, will be published in the spring of 2015. And your foray into playwriting is your short play, First Snow. And your first full-length play, The Good Villain, will be released in the fall of this year. And you have some other unpublished works, including Ode to Molly, Walking with Anansi, Book One, and I guess is that set in Jamaica? Because you have Jamaica in parentheses.
It's set in Jamaica. It's kind of autobiographical, so it takes me from 4 years old up to 17 years old.
Mm-hmm. And then Walking with Anansi 2, book 2 is in New York. Is Anansi like Anansi the spider, just or Anansi meaning something else?
Exactly, the spider. It's West African primarily.
Yes.
West African mythology. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's talk first about this wonderful book, your first novel, Broken Gorge, and how your training and your academic training and your career as a writer, how do you combine the two, your engineering career and your career as a writer? How did you find time for the writing in the midst of seemingly a different type of academic and career focus?
Well, the formal writing, meaning to say structuring a story and writing it, came after my engineering career. That lasted for 20 years. But strange enough, I'd be going to work, driving to work, and my mind would just be flooded with either stories or ideas of stories or the actual language of stories. So I knew that pretty soon, especially as my engineering career advanced, that I had to turn to writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But actually, the writing bug started when I was still in elementary school in Jamaica. I wrote for the local newspaper, the Gleaner, and got things published there. And all along, I'm a little farm boy walking around. I just be filled with stories. So I knew from a very young child, that I had to write. But the writing came into play after the engineering career, career closed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So how closely does your rearing in Jamaica reflected place and characters of the Albion in Broken Gorge, a place that seems kind of rustic, and the story begins with sort of the intrusion of wanting to take a highway through the town, which is going to really disrupt everything. And so your protagonist, begins by, first he goes to the council meetings and the other types of meetings, and sort of develops a rapport with the engineer and the team that's going to bring, not civilization, but you sort of just changes this small, really wonderful town into something quite different from what it is. And then over the course of the story, we learn how, sort of about the richness of this place. Because a lot of times when you're from the outside, you can't really, see, kind of the interruption that you could bring to a city if you just change something so dramatically, like the traffic flow or just, put a highway down, the seemingly benign or road that doesn't seem like there's much happening unless you take time to learn about, the history of the place and hear the voices of the people. And I was just wondering if you could maybe talk about sort of setting seems to be really everything for this particular work. And then the stories, and then you bring in the African religion and traditions, and it's just such a beautiful, beautiful story, and it's so scenic. The writing is really descriptive, and the characters are we just really love them. Grandmother, Brother Walk, and you like walking, and you've got a character called Brother Walk, when his name is changed. Talk a little bit about that.
Thank you very much. I don't know where to start. With the village itself, it's a copy of my father's birthplace, Albion, in Western St. Mary. And he took us there. where I grew up, my own home is around, say, 50 miles from his home. But he took us there as to visit relatives when we were young. And from the first time I went there, I was just struck with the humanity and the grace of these people. It's like walking into a different world. The world I was brought up in was a kind of a British world, the world of my parents, especially from my mother's point of view, strictly British in sort of everything, religion, behavior. But when I went back to my father's village as a little boy, I knew I was in a different place, a different moray, different way of understanding the world, different way of living. And I got, say, stuck in it. I just enchanted. I wanted that. So when I was around 11 years old, I did the unseemly. I ran away from home. That's my parents' home, to my father's village. Walked all 15 miles.
Wow.
And lived there for a summer because I wanted to know what this thing was about, this strange, beautiful place. And so I spent a good summer there. And the next year, did the same thing, ran away again, and got another piece of that life. And so and that life is really African, in a sense that these people were mostly Ashanti, and they could be from other regions of West Africa, but we say Ashanti. Primarily, that's a language that was spoken. My sense now is that it's more Fanti. The language is more Fanti, and but in those days and still now, I believe, Ashanti was the dominant culture. West African culture was there. So even if you speak Fanti, you're going to say you're Ashanti. So let's say it's an Ashanti village. And my father grew up there, and I got an early touch of this culture. It's like a bug. It's in you. And so when I started to... So from then, I began to formulate ideas about the differences of this strong English culture I was brought up in, and this strong, powerful, but loving, kind, tender, gracious African Ashanti culture. So I grew up split, so to speak, loving my father's village because it was kind of my soul, but liking my mother's village because it had structure, and it had a certain type of structure, and it pointed to some direction that I kind of liked. But I know there's something not wholesome about it. If you want to feel love, you go to my father's village. If you want to look at the future and for growth and development, that sort of stuff, you look to my mother's village. So I was brought up, as I said, in two worlds. And so in life, I took my mother's village, I say it that way, and that led me into science. The curiosity of all of that led me into science. But still a love of home, my father's home, that African life, led me into myself, into storytelling, and I think, in a sense, at the richest part of my life.
Wow, how interesting. the soul and structure, and they were kind of juxtaposed, not necessarily, until you embodied them, they weren't necessarily two places that came together. I mean, the roads didn't necessarily meet literally, yet within yourself, you embody both soul and structure. So it's kind of interesting, huh?
Yeah, that is true. And it is so remarkable that when I came to this country first and started studying physics, many times I wanted to leave college and go back home. And it's not because my grades were not good. I just didn't think physics had that, it didn't touch my soul. It inspired my mind. And I could do the math and I could work the problems out with some struggle. It wasn't all easy. Mm-hmm. Not a struggle. It's a very difficult subject. But I love the challenge. And I like to know that there was some predictability about the world. So that caught me going. But at the same time, I knew I was split off. The more I went into physics, it's more of a split off from that early life. And And so the great struggle I had to stay in school and to graduate was to stitch those two pieces together. That was my struggle. How do you make these two beautiful worlds work internally?
Yeah. When I was in Jamaica a while back, I visited where Marcus Garvey was born and raised, as well as the tomb of Bob Marley. And Marcus Garvey is from St. Anne's, right? St. Anne's Parish?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is where your father's village is. Is it really far from there?
Not really far. They are contiguous. In other words, you can walk from one. We call them parishes in Jamaica. You can walk from one, and there are 14 of them. You can walk from St. Mary. In fact, I did. My home, where my mother's home, I put it that way, because it's a matriarchal society. Let me just say that. So even though my father built it, when we got married, it became my mother's house. She was the boss, in other words. So I see my mother's house. I walk from there to school in St. Anne, 3 miles, all uphill, and then you'd walk back in the evening. So there you go. You walk from one parish to the next school. But actually, my mother's father is from Brownstown, and that is Marcus Garvey's home in St. Anne.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's cute.
And actually, to put it a little more, my mother's cousin was Marcus Garvey's last wife and secretary.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, really.
Oh.
He told me.
Wow.
Don't ask me the name right now, but if you look up the story. That, yes, yeah. So
oh,
where,
that's so,
so
awesome.
Yeah.
Ah. Oh, that's, wow, that's really phenomenal because there have been books written about her.
Yes.
Because, you know, she continued the work after Marcus Garvey died.
Yes,
she was really wonderful. Has she passed?
Yes, long ago.
Long ago, okay. Yeah, I guess so, because she would be really up there if she was still alive. But, yeah, I definitely know her work. Oh, and that's your relative.
And my mother's.
Oh, that's really something. I want you to talk some more about the story itself. When we enter the story, you know, when we actually get the backstory, when the narrator, Victor Rollins, you know, starts telling, you know, the engineering team what's going on and why they can't put, they need to he's already redrawn a route of the highway that will not interrupt, you know, Albion's life. But he brings him to this place called the Bomb Yard and House of God, and they look at him and it's like, okay, like, what's the big deal here? You got this falling down, you know, place, and, you know, you got these kids running through, and what's the big deal with this yard? I mean, why is it so important? They definitely couldn't see it just by looking. And so he tells them the story, and in the story, you know, we meet these wonderful characters like Prince and his son, Dada, who becomes Brother Walk. We've got Granny. We've got Dada's good friend, Twig. He's sort of, it's like his little brother. You know, they're just all these phenomenal characters. And then we have this hill. And in the hill, you know, they have these different levels, physical, you know, gradations. You know, we've got the lower yard, and we got the hill folks, and we've got the people that are on the very, very top. And there's sort of like colonialism, you know, mixed with, you know, the former slave owners. And meanwhile, you know, the kids are growing up together. You know, black kids are growing up with the white kids. And it's just, and also you bring in, you know, East Indian culture and Chinese culture, because all that's in Jamaica. So it's just really interesting how you mix it all up there. So you could maybe talk about the place, you know, give our audience a sense of the terrain and the people of Broken Gourds.
Yes, I hope you can do justice of that. But part of the book is written in at two levels. One is a physical level, and the other is kind of a metaphorical level. And you, in the story, you mentioned the three levels. One is the farm level, where, of course, there are the great sugar plantations and slavery and all of that. And in one sense, that represents one level of society. Then Jamaica, being as hilly as it is, let's say we go up some hills to a plateau, and that's a middle ground. And that's where kind of the servants of the, or the rulers, or the masters of, and also the workers for the plantation would live. It's not much agricultural use for the land. It's not where the big farms were, but it's where the workers were. But further up is we find people like Granny, and that's where sort of runaway people who ran away from slavery, would live. And in Jamaica, there's big maroon communities, and you can go and read about that. But there are also communities that are not exactly maroon communities, but function like maroon communities. And that's where Granny lived, way up on the hill. And it was so remote that it wouldn't make sense to go after her, and also so sparse, so few people. So they were just left there by themselves. But something else happened there. Their African roots remained with them. In other words, they spoke, I think it was Fanti, but I'm going to say Ashanti. Because if you meet an Ashanti person on the street, or two Ashanti guys meet and they don't exactly know they're Ashanti, and you ask them, what language are you guys speaking? They'll say Fanti, which is it is like the French, my understanding of the Middle East. I think it's more Fanti. And we can also tell by the names of the people, they're more Fanti than Ashanti names. But let's get rid of all of that and say, way up in this village, the Ashanti culture was left pretty much intact. And that's kind of where my father grew up. And when he grew up, the stories he told me is that people like Granny, friends, they spoke Ashanti. And what I can tell you of my own self, when I went there, I ate Ashanti food, or food prepared in the Ashanti manner. And you see the social structure and the lifestyle completely different. So again, the physical geography of the country, in sort of metaphorical terms, connects well to the social structure of the country. So I use it that way in the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's also, you know, there are a couple of love stories, multi-generational love stories. We've got a love story between Granny, and I was looking for her love interest, and I can't find his name. And then he's got this donkey that mule. Tell me again.
Janga.
Yeah, right, Janga. Yeah, and that, you know, that name there is like, oh, that is totally an African name. And then his is it a mule that he doesn't ride, he walks? That's like
it's a donkey.
Donkey,
That's kind of well, and the donkey's name is called Onway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Onway. Yeah.
Here's a nice, gentle, you know, peaceful man with a donkey that should serve him. But a donkey has its own way and will not submit to the will of the master.
right. Mhm. Yeah, and then we have, you know, we've got Twig and we've got Ruth, you know, another love story. And then, you know, we've got some villains, you know, in the story. You know, the inspector is a villain. He reminds me a little bit of George W. Bush and how he held on to a grudge, you know, with Saddam Hussein because of what happened with his father, you know,
yes.
the senior Bush. And so you don't know the backstory. You just think, oh, you know, they're weapons of mass destruction. Like, no, it's not. He's mad because, you know, this president, former president of Iraq, you know, shamed his father. And so that's why he's got to do this, take his whole nation to war. And then you wonder, what's going on with the inspector? What's the deal with him? And then you find out, you know, sort of the backstory there. It's like, oh, it's personal. And, you know, it's really interesting, you know, what goes on with the inspector and how he is connected to someone who's using his spiritual access to undermine the good of the community. And you talk about sort of how, you know, all people that are, you know, who are connected to spirit are not necessarily good people. Why don't you talk a little bit about that? Because we were speaking off the air about, you know, we think about sort of the predecessor to what people think about when they say Rastafarianism, you know, that particular spiritual tradition that's associated with Jamaica. It goes deeper than that current or more popular presentation.
Yes, your mind is so rich this morning. So let me just take the Rastafarian thing because it's such a strong movement in Jamaica right now. And first of all, I want to say bless Rastafari. I want to say that. But a lot of people believe that Rastafari, as it is, it's just floating out of nothing. It's a very complicated story, and the origins go way back to Ethiopia, and who we are as Ethiopian Jews or remnants of Ethiopian Jews that came, walked all the way from Ethiopia across Africa on foot to the West, got shipped out into the Caribbean plantations. And my second book. There's a book that deals with this in very much detail. It's called Fishhook River. So I'm not going to go into that too much of that right now. But there are people coming from Ethiopia, Jews, into Jamaica. But when you came to Jamaica, we lost so much. We lost your language. We lost your culture. We lost a lot of, you know, if you're stuck on the plantations, not like Granny up in the hills, you lost so much. But on the plantations, there is one movement from Africa called Komena. And Komena is like a catch-all for a lot of the religions of West Africa. In Jamaica, that's what it is. So under this Komena umbrella, you'll find things like Obia and Zuzu and the old Jewish religion and so on and so forth, all caught up in there. So Komena was like an incubator, a spiritual incubator for all of these old African religions. But after slavery was over, people began to claim their individual religions. So Obia became itself very strong, Zuzu became itself very strong, and so did the Rastafari. Rastafarianism became very strong. And so we have these kind of movements coming out of Komena. So Fishhook River is really, I'm sorry, Providence Pond is really a celebration of Komena, because without it, I don't think Jamaican culture would be what it is today. We wouldn't have that great sense of spirituality and a great sense of African culture, because as I said, I believe that Komena was the incubator. It kept us spiritually alive, who we were during slavery. And if I can say one more thing, one of the reasons it was tolerated is because under Komena you'd find masquerade, which is another kind of African religion. And under all of those things, where we celebrated with drums and music, the white folks saw entertainment. So whereas they would not allow Judaism to flourish because it's anti-Christianity, they would allow Komena to flourish because to them it was entertainment. Look at these folks dancing. Oh, let them dance for us. Let them do this for us. Let them do that for us. Let's entertain us. So Khomeini was left there for one reason, for entertainment. So, but then when colonialism was kind of over, or slavery was over, colonialism coming in, Khomeini could be released or broke down, and we have this big release of spirituality in Jamaica. Are you still there?
Of course. Yeah, I'm listening.
Oh, good. It says 9 o'clock. I'm wondering. So I don't know if that answered your question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. I'm asking you so much in each question. I'm going to go back to a couple of things. Do you have time to stay on a little bit longer? Okay. Going back to Bomb Yard and House
yes.
of God, within the story, we see, sort of juxtaposition of the Protestant church and we've got Bomb Yard and the House of God, which sort of takes some of its cues from Christianity, but then goes further because there's a mix of African spirituality and Christianity in Bomb Yard, and there's a whole lot that's embodied within the character. Brother Walker or Dada, when we meet Dada, he's almost like a leper. He's got sores that run. He can't do any work. His father, Prince, is worried about him because Prince is a man who has land and his children work for themselves. They work for the family. They don't work for, the Europeans or the white people that run everything, but they don't run him. and so we've got this character, Dada, who is the youngest of the children, and he's doing these little jobs. He's trying to he seems to be really unfocused. What he's really known for is he has this beautiful voice. He's always singing and he's always praying and he sings in the choir church, and that's sort of like his claim to fame. But he's older kid, but older than the other children. But he goes and gets the water for the household. He takes out the sheep or the lambs, or he does real little jobs. And he even in those jobs he's not real focused because he might forget to get the water or he might forget to bring the the sheep back in. And or he might even break the gourd that he carries the water in and just be really, really devastated around that. He likes to sit under the mango tree and eat until he's full and then go to sleep and then dream. He's really in touch with the other realms,
Yes.
The spirits come to him. So as long as you could talk about Dada and Bomb Yard and House of God and the way that within your book, broken gourds, spirit walks and what Granny talks about, it's like spirit talks to her too and they walk. I'm talking about the ancestors and Prince is really against that. It's like, no, we don't go there. But Dada, he's really special. and he has a special gift. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit and the whole idea of the way that within your story, maybe because Jamaica is a matriarchal society, maybe that's why we see a lot of female imagery within this realm of spirit in the story.
Yes. God, where to start?
start with Dada.
Dada. So thank you. So to understand an African-American, anybody from the Caribbean, to really understand us, diaspora people, to really understand us, you must understand that we are first spirit people. And I don't care how rich you are, how scientific you are, how whatever you are, we are, first of all, basically spirit people. That's who we are. And you talk about Christianity and all that. All of those Christian, let me just say, Christian religion, which we look at today as foreign, has its real roots in Egypt and came out of Egypt after the fall of the pharaohs into West Africa and get twined up with other pieces of African spirituality. So in essence, at the root of it, at the very base, Christianity has nothing. It's a part of the old mix, spiritual mix, historically and in real life. So all of us that were, so if you're Hebrew coming from Ethiopia, you still have part of that old Egyptian stuff in you. If you're coming from West Africa, you have that spiritual stuff in you. So you come into the Caribbean, and what do you have? You have basically a spiritual person. And I'm saying a spiritual person because what we would practice as science, we know science because we know water boils, we know fire burns, that's all science. But it's not science in the sense that let me figure out that this electron moved from here to here to cause this sort of stuff. We don't understand it that way. We understand it in a much more global way. We don't separate the world into little pieces. We understand things in a very global way, or another way to say it, we understand things in a very intuitive way. And so it's hard to put your finger on spirituality to define what it is because it's not scientific. But to really understand any African person, any person from the diaspora, you have to really believe that at bottom we are just wholly a whole person. We are not divided up into little pieces. We are whole people. And in that wholeness is our spirituality. So it's not only that we are whole in sense, is that the way we look at the world, we're a part of the world, the world is a part of us. In other words, the dog out there, the rat, the goat, the sheep, it's not separate from you because it's a part of spirit, it's a part of you. So in a sense, when you eat an animal, you're eating yourself, and that self becomes you, and you become that self. And so you're one whole thing. And so out of all of that comes a great respect. And I say that again. Out of all of that wholeness, spiritual wholeness, comes a great respect for yourself, for the world, for people. And that's really why these folks in Albion were against cutting a road through the village. Because you're dissecting the village, you're destroying the village. But if you have to put a road, put a wholesome road, let the road not go through our spiritual center, which is the Bamiyard. Let it not cut through your spiritual soul and hurt you. Let it not be just for money. Let it be for the goodness of the land. Let it be for the goodness of the people. Let it be a goodness of that community. It's not that you're coming in, cutting a road to extract industrial stuff and take it out and leave the people destitute. No, let the road be a wholesome road. Let it be a healthy road. Let it be a wise road. And so that's the basis of our spirituality, respect for self and for what's around you, because what's around you is also a part of self. And if you really love and respect yourself, then the whole world takes on a different meaning.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's really beautiful. Yeah, and with regards to respect and Dada's leadership, because it's just really, really wonderful to watch him come into his mission, because no one knows except Granny that, you know, he's special.
Yes.
And not special in a derogatory sense, special in a good sense, and that he's going to play an important role in the community, because he would, like, walk up to the top of the hill where Granny is, and he would look out and say, one day this is all going to be mine. And that particular desire, you know, that sort of feeds into an aspect of his person and his ego that's not healthy, and he has to work that out of himself. So he's... You know, he's really a really good model of humanity for everyone who's watching him. He apologizes when he does wrong. He sort of led to define ways to through behavior. Like, for instance, when he finds that he is just too arrogant and too self-centered, you know, he starts taking a meal to one way, own way. You know, he starts feeding him so that he can learn that, you know, you're not greater than any other of God's creation, you know, and that you need to humble yourself. Because if you don't, you could commit some really, you could really undo all of the good things that you've done in, you know, establishing a space in the village called, you know, Bomb Yard, you know, House of God. So that's just really wonderful, you know, this particular character, Brother Walk, how he, you know, through his life and through his example, you know, he shows how, you know, within the community we can, you know, there doesn't need to be any competition, and just the way, you know, he goes out and they have this baptism on August 1st, you know, with all the different churches, and he shows how we can all benefit and how he, you know, so that there's no conflict between the Protestant church and their community church. He said, okay, well, we could just move our service to this so then people can do both. I mean, he's just like, he's just such a great, you know, put in quotation marks, politician, but a good one, you know.
You have such a wonderful grasp of the story. I'm hearing you talking about it, and I'm just laughing. Because that's exactly the image I wanted to portray. You got it. You really have the story, Wanda. Thank you so much for what you're saying. Yes, but so where should I pick up on this? So Brother Walk is an example of this deep spirituality that runs through the Jamaican soul. And it doesn't, and though you may become great, it doesn't make you any greater than the least in the community, because you're he's that donkey also, and that's the whole point, and that donkey is him. So if Brother Walk is going to be of any thing of any stature, he's got to respect and treat the donkey right. He's also got to treat the land right, and the community right, and the water right, and everything like that. So yes, that is, and in a sense, that's what we're missing so much today. We're missing, we think more of money as God, but let me not go into that, because that's Fishhook River, the story of money. This is the story of spirituality, of love and wholeness. So, but it shows you what happens when you break that paradigm and greed takes the place of love. And that's the destructive element that you're referring to in Brother Walk. He lost his path, greed replaced love, and it was heading for destruction. And if it were not for the older folk like Granny and Janga, the whole district would have been destroyed because of his greed and selfishness.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's the call. Actually, for the story, you mentioned how that goes back to the Bush family. If this nation, represented by Janga and Granny, had really stood up and took a high moral ground, the nation itself, and said, "No, this is right, and here's the right path," we could not have had that war. So it's not under the leaders that move the country forward. It's also the last voter, the least voter, and your voice must count, and your voice should count. Unless it counts, then we get the leadership that we deserve.
Mhm.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. Certainly. And then, you know, there, you know, if people want to think of it that way, I mean, there's magic, you know, in the story, Broken Gourds, because it's, you know, there's suspense, because we don't know what's going to happen. I mean, really, I mean, when Rollins has, you know, he has this, for a minute, I think he's not going to tell a story, and then all of a sudden, you know, the space opens up, and people stop trying to rush him, because he knows that if in order to hear him, you have to be in a certain spiritual space and place. And if the people, the engineers, are not going to go to that particular space within themselves, then they won't hear him. So there's no use, you know, telling the story or sharing with them the history of the place. And so it's really it's just really really wonderful the way you tell the story. You really
the way you're telling it, Wanda. That's what's wonderful. Hacking me up.
Yeah, it's
you got to do
really,
my second. You got to do another book. This is so much fun. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. It's just Broken Gorge. It's just such a wonderful, rich experience. Just being in this creative space that you know a lot of us have never been to, and it's just just really wonderful. I was just thinking I read a lot of Maladome Somme's books, and he's from Burkina Faso in West Africa. And one of the last books of his that I read, I also saw a video of him speaking about the whole idea of ritual in the African sense, and in the close relationship that people of African descent and Africans, continental Africans, have with the spirit realm, with the ancestors. I mean, it's like you can't do anything if you're not connected to your ancestors. I mean, it's that important. And we see with Dada and then Brother Walk how, he visits these places in his dreams. I mean, and he sees, these ancestors, and then he'll talk to the elders like Granny or Janga, and ask them, what things mean. And Janga says, "Well, I can't interpret it for you." like the thing is within itself, its own entity. Just be with it, and it'll reveal itself to you. And so then, Dada, he'll try to go dream some more, and he'll dream about, this bird. And then later on, in his waking, life, he'll see the bird, and it's like, ah. And then he'll see the face that he saw in his dream, and it's like, oh. And it's like, okay, what does this mean, and what does that mean? And then sometimes he gets it wrong, but he stays with it. And what's really good is that because his soul is – his intention is good, the spirit works with him. He messes up, he gets captured because he needs to be shook up a little bit, and then he gets back to his folks, because he has to get taken out of the situation because he's going to undo all the good. It's just like really, really cool the way you sort of pulled all this together.
Yeah, thank you so much. There's this very deep spirituality in this world. And you mentioned magic, so let me just add another word to that, magical realism. We see that as a magical realism as a genre in emergent literature. But in Jamaican life, in African life, and, with us, it's not an art form, it's a way of life. And you talk about the magic, but it's the magic really of connecting to this deeper world which you can't put your fingers around, and it sustains you and brings you to your higher self, but you cannot define it because it's beyond definition. Some of us will call it God, some of us will call it the one or whatever, but it's when you say God, you begin to name it, and then it becomes materialistic in a sense. But that sort of destroys a part of it, because what's beneath this physical world, what's beneath it, which scientists are trying to figure out, it's so darn huge that we cannot figure it out. We cannot figure it out. Just the simple thing of what's the beginning of the beginning? Where did things start? We can't tell that. But if you're connected with the deep mystery of the beneath world, of the intuitive world, then you don't question it. You accept it, and you allow it to lead you. And this is where I think our freedom comes from, and our nobility comes from, having the faith, having this deep faith in this unseen world, this unseen, mysterious, magical world, having the faith in it to lead us.
Mhm. Yeah. I always think when I think about Jamaica, I think about the Caribbean specifically. There's a certain type of person that's groomed and developed there, because when even though you were enslaved, it was a different type of enslavement in that, you know, you could actually go to the mountains and get away. You know, you got nannies, you know, tradition, you know, that's the story of Nanny of the Maroons, you know, her story is really big. And then we think about, you know, sort of the first free republic of African people in Haiti, and we think people don't know that Bukman, you know, was Jamaican, you know, and he, you know, along with Mom Fatiman, they gave that call, you know, like, we got to kick these white folks out of here. They just, like, messing up stuff. You know, they call the meeting on the mountains to call the ancestors to give the people the strength to be able to do this work, because it didn't happen overnight that, you know, the Africans were able to, enslaved Africa, able to take the land back, you know, from the people that had, you know, enslaved them and brought them, you know, from Africa. And so, you know, that kind of, you know, spirit, you know, it still comes through, you know, when you think about sort of the folks that have come out of Jamaica and the Caribbean. You know, we're talking Haiti, you know, Trinidad, Tobago, you know, et cetera. But I also wanted to mention, I've been to Ethiopia, and I was there last summer, and I had known about Shashamani, but I knew about Shashamani before I went to Ethiopia last year, because there's a restaurant club in Oakland called Shashamani, and I had known about it before that too. And I thought, how wonderful, you know, that, you know, King Selassie, you know, set aside this space in Ethiopia for people of the African diaspora to have a home, you know, Shashamani. And I just thought that was just so wonderful. I wish you could talk a little bit about about place. And also I wanted to ask you, third thing, if you have, like, if you could read something from your book. I really like the scene where Dada has his first dream, and this, you know, he's like crossing this river, and it's scary because it's really deep and there's a lot of turmoil, but this ancestor that, you know, he sees often is this woman or young woman, you know, beckons him to keep on coming, you know, crossing the water, and he trusts her, and he does.
I wish I could do a little reading for you, but my glasses, I don't have my glasses with me.
Oh. Next time then, okay.
wish I sort of told me, but I left my glasses this morning. But, but that's one of, oh my God, you must have spent hours on this book. Because you're so acquainted with some of the deep pieces of it, I'm really amazed. But you asked me to talk a little about. Did you want me to talk a little about Rastafari and Haile Selassie?
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I said that story is spoken very clearly in Fishhook River. It's a book, and also the play I'm writing, that's a play we spoke about yesterday. It's called Secrets of Seder. So it takes you into a whole other world, or the good villain. But what that's all about is that here's the glory of Haile Selassie. In the 1930s, when the Rastafarian movement separated from this big umbrella Kumina culture and became its own thing, we were doubted. The Sephardics in Jamaica would look at us and say, look at you, you don't look like us, you're not Jews. But when I was growing up as a child, we'd be doing something wrong and somebody would say, don't do that. And you'd say, why? You said, You're the original Jew. You're Hebrew. You're original Jew. So in the culture itself, we were, as children, called up many times to a very high standard, not knowing really who we were. They were saying, you're the original Jew. You're Hebrew. So, and a lot of those people would be people of the Rastafarian world. But even then, Rastafarian was not a word you could mention, because the Jamaican government was anti-Rastafarian. You'd be beaten up, throwing you in jail. Why? Because you're really upsetting the status quo. If you're Rastafarian and you're Hebrew, and then they would have to explain to themselves, why are they putting God's children in slavery? You see the contradiction?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so so even if, so if you're Hebrew, in the real sense of the word, coming out of Solomon and David, why are Christians putting you in slavery? So it was this big contradiction in Jamaican society, where even the Jamaican government of people from Africa would put down Rastafarianism in the beginning. We can't allow this down because we are Christians, and they are, so it's put down. But the glory of Haile Selassie in the 30s is when he came to Jamaica and said, yes, you're my people. Over 1 million of us, of you, were put in slavery, not only in Jamaica, not only in the Caribbean, but also in America. You came all across and you were put in slavery. And I'm accepting you. And yes, you're my people. I'm accepting you. And yes, I am from the line of David. I am from the line of Solomon. Because all to be king in Ethiopia, you have to be from the line of Solomon. It's a requirement. So, and he's from that line, bloodline, and he's saying, yes, we are the people. So just imagine that you're at the base of society, and all of a sudden, someone who is from the highest realm, spiritual realm, in the spiritual, in the Christian world, a son of Solomon, saying, you are my people. It takes the entire thing and put upside down.
Mm-hmm.
And so Rastafarianism became, if you're Rasta, you became like the greatest person on earth, because you now you're recognized by your king as one of his subjects. And so Rastafarianism took on tremendous meaning. There's also one other thing I want to quickly add. When Haile Selassie came to Jamaica, there's this red carpet stretched out for him by the authorities that he should walk on, you know, the red carpet treatment. He said, I don't want any red carpet. I'm taking off my shoes and I'm walking on the ground from my plane to meet my people, the Rastafarian delegations waiting for him. And in Jamaica, we call it gronation. Gronation means walking on the ground. So here's this king, this great king from the line of Solomon, accepting us, the lowest level of society, as his people. And then not only that, giving us a piece of land in Jamaica, in his country, in Ethiopia, and said, here you are, it's yours. And it's not only given to Jamaicans, it's given to Africa, the diaspora that claim to be Hebrew. You see, so that was a tremendous thing to him. Tremendous.
Mm. Yeah. Thank you. This is just, wow. I'm so happy that we're able to talk a little bit longer. Well, if you don't mind, I could read something from your book, if you don't mind.
Sure, right up.
Okay, cool.
Please do.
And I was trying to find, like, what section I was going to read something from the source. And I've been talking about Dada herding sheep, but it's goats.
Okay.
I realize, his father has goats. And in this particular chapter, the father, he's really worried about, Prince is really worried about Dada. Dada's really trying his patience because Dada's mother dies when does she die when he's born or does she die while he's a child? But anyway, I know that his mother doesn't raise him. His granny is like his mother figure. And
yes.
And his dad, he's been single for like 10 years, and he's not an old man. He's a young man. He wants to get married and have a family, but he doesn't want. He wants to have another set of children, but he doesn't want his wife to inherit a family, particularly Dada. So he wants to like give his son some land, let him build a home like he's given land to his other children, as they came of age, and he wants them to get married and have a family because he doesn't want to have to worry about him. It's like, man, I don't know if this child is going to ever be able to, like, live by himself and have a family. I mean, he's not even interested in girls. Like, what's wrong with him? So Prince is, like, really, really worried. And I also like the way you have with Prince. He's kind of, like, straddling, you know, a lot of different social classes, because he's right there with, you know, these the colonizers and former and descendants of the slave owners, because, you know, he's not controlled by, you know, the municipality. I mean, he's a powerful man, and then with, you know, coming from, even if he doesn't believe it, and coming from a spirit tradition where his mother is, you know, like a priestess, people don't mess with him, or if they do, there's gonna be some consequences. And so, you know, he sits, you know, sort of like in the scene where, you know, we go to church with the family, and he's like, he goes to the table where, you know, the pastor and the inspector and the doctor and his wife and the doctor's mixed race, you know, African and some other things, and then they've got the school teacher and the headmaster. And then you've got Prince, and so he's like thinking, his mind, like, you know, I should like pull up a chair and sit with these people. I mean, they're better than me, and I could probably out, you know, with regards to my resources, I probably have more, you know, wealth than they do. And it's like, no. So he stands there, you know, as opposed to sitting with them, and then he goes back to his folks, and it's like, those are his people. But he is kind of like set apart from them as well. So it's interesting sort of being in that place where you don't have a place that you put Prince.
Yes. Did the woman talk a little about that?
Yeah, sure. And then I'll read something. Mm-hmm.
Prince is a sort of a person who, as you said, is quite independent because he has land. And with the land, he doesn't need... He doesn't need the rich European folk to make a living. He makes his independent living. He works his land. He is totally independent. But Prince is kind of the person who is split between African spiritualism and the comforts of that African village and the need... not really to be accepted, but to be recognized by the other world, by the rich world. They're not going to give him that acceptance unless he obeys their principles. He does what they want. But in order to do that, he's got to give up his Africanness. It's really his Jamaican story, but say his Africanness. So Prince is caught in between the two. Granny, on the other hand, is quite free in herself. She is quite African. Very content with that, and very happy with herself. Prince is sitting on a knife blade. He's wavering in between, and Dada is kind of just really floating. He's not coming into himself, but because of her faith in humanity or understanding of people, Granny really understands intuitively what Dada is. So you have these three influences in the story, and they set up tension for the story, and also brings the reader into the personalities of these people. And so as we go on, we see, or we will see, how this tension releases.
Mhm. Yeah. And you have, you know, Granny, she wears traditional African clothes with the brilliant colors, and she's actually raising a baby that she delivers. She's also the midwife. She delivers all the babies, and she makes them their first set of clothing, which is just really, really wonderful. When you think about the clothing as sort of like a metaphor, you know, sort of wrapping them in African cloth, and you think about sort of the rituals around that. And that her hand has touched all of the children that were born in this village. That's quite amazing, you know,
yes.
Sort of that actual physical tapestry that she's weaving, you know, with
yes.
that. Mm-hmm.
And that's factual. That is factual. In Jamaica, if you go into the cities or the little towns, when I was a little boy, you'd see women dressed like that from head to toe. It's all African style.
Mhm.
Yes.
Wow. Interesting. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so I've been trying to figure out where to start in this chapter that give people a sense. I was like, okay. Yeah. So I'm gonna
While you're figuring where to start, let me just say one thing. I'm sitting here, toting my mouth about Ghana and all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But so people, Jamaicans who are from Nigeria must be wondering, why I'm not saying anything about Nigeria? Where is Nigeria in all of this? But for that I say, read Providence Pond, and you'll see the Ashanti culture, the Yoruba culture coming out. Read Fishhook River, you'll see the Nigerian culture coming out. So just be patient with me. Right now I'm in Ghana, then I go to Nigeria, and in all of them, in Ethiopia comes into place. So just bear with me. All right. Thank you.
Nice. So where can people get Providence Pond? That came out in 2006. Where can people get it?
Providence Pond, you can get it online on my bookstore, my anansibooks.com.
Okay, tell it to people.
Mm-hmm. Anansibooks.com. You can go there and get it and get an e-book copy. And if you wish to get a paperback, you can get it on Amazon.
Okay. So Anansi, spell Anansi for people again.
A-N-A-N-C-Y. So it's Nancy with an A before it. A-N-A-N-C-Y. So one word, it's anansibooks.com.
Okay, great. And then you've got, you know, your plays, and that's right. Right now, you're working to get the Good Villain staged this year.
Oh, this.
I know it's going to be released this year, 2014. So,
first,
are you looking?
First, what I'm working on for this year.
Okay. All right. Cool. So how do people stay in touch with you by going? How do people like follow what you're up to?
It's a good question. I've not been marketing for a long time. I'm just getting back into marketing. So I'm building a new website. And in the website, you can you'll be able to find my work. But right now, if you go on Facebook and look for Anansi Books, you'll find me there. Just look for Anansi Books on Facebook. Or my name, Beresford McLean. I do most of my postings I do on Anansi Books. You know, which is on Facebook. Or if you go to the website, you can go to, if you want to email me, there's my email address or a phone number on the contact us.
Mm-hmm. You want to give your phone number?
Yeah, sure. You can give it out.
Oh, you go ahead.
08-286-0726. But I'd much prefer if you email me, and the email is info@anansibooks.com. So it's info@anansibooks.com. I'd love to get your feedback, your comments. That'd be really appreciated.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. All righty. So we're going to start here and see where it takes us, how much I'm going to go into this particular chapter, which the book just gets better and better and better. It's like, it's such a great read. So we were talking about, you know, Dada not being really fit to work around the farm, you know, so his father was trying to find something. Everybody has, you know, has their, you know, has to have a job in the running of the household. Otherwise, you feel useless, right? So he had to find something that Dada was good at, something that he could be successful at, just for the boy's self-esteem, so he could feel that he was a part of the family. And so, you know, with a lot of trial and error, you know, Dada, you know, was assigned to get the water for the family, you know, to fill up, you know, their the place where, you know, they would get their drinking water each day. So Dada's treks for water sometimes took him further upstream to find clean water. This did not matter much, since Dada was in the company of the children from the village, and they fetched the water together. So you would expect that things were good for Dada. He found his niche away from the hot sun and rough life of the farm, staying around the house and doing few comparably easy tasks. Needless to say, he became the envy of his brothers and the older boys of the village. One day, though, his comfortable life changed forever. His memory failed him again. He drove the goats into the pen, but forgot to close the gate. When Prince came in late that evening, he called Dada and questioned him in his usual manner about his chores. They spoke about the goats and the water. Dada assured Prince that all was well, that the goats were fed and sufficient water was in the yaba, the huge clay pot used as a water container. With that, Dada went to bed. Early the next morning, Prince got ready to go to the farm. This promised to be a day of hard work. It was banana day. The fruit had to be taken from the farm and transported by donkey cart down to the wharf, where it would be loaded on the banana boat bound for England. A very special sense of urgency prevailed. It was the end of July and one of the last working days in the month for Albion. Within a few days, it would be the 1st of August. For the folk of Albion, especially for Granny and her household, that was the most important day in the year, far more important to them than Easter. It grew to become even more important than Christmas. The work had to be done so that the 1st of August festivities could start. In the homes, this was a time of sacred storytelling, where the adventures of days gone by were handed down, father to son, uncle to nephew, and mother to child. Every iota of personal interest and worth was remembered and relived. Hardships, failures, and simple individual triumphs from which an individual, a family, a community, and a country had been built and tied together was repeated in warm, colorful detail. This made the listener own them, wanted to carry on the same cherished traditions, and engendered a sense of pride and oneness in a diverse yet similar people. Consequently, hardly any work would be done during August. "Dada, Dada, come here quickly," Prince called. "The goats are in the garden. Go and get them out." Dada stumbled out of his bedroom and into the garden to see what had happened. In his clumsy, half-sleepy state, he tried to get the goats, but in doing so, he trampled and destroyed more of the vegetables than the goats had done initially. Prince became livid. Knowing, however, what his own duties were for that day, Prince shouted some instructions about the goats and the gardens to Dada and hurried off to his fields. About midday, Prince returned home to check on Dada's progress with the goats. To his great surprise and dismay, he found Dada sitting with his back against the goat pen. A pile of mango skins and seeds lay beside him as he reclined against the pen with his eyes closed. Dada seemed to be totally absorbed in one of his usual daydreams while the goats lay in the vegetable gardens chewing their cuds. Prince again became angry, but he was unsure what to do next. He literally felt like killing Dada. And then I'm going to skip down to another section. He went and, you know, conferred with his mother. He talked to her a lot. It's really great how within your story there's respect, you know, between the generations. Sons consult their mothers, grandchildren consult their elders and listen to them. Don't just consult, but actually listen to what they say. Even, you know, Dada even consults Twig, who is, you know, a lot younger than him. So, and he listens to what Twig says. And then he, you know, he listens to, you know, what the children you know, grown up now, Ruth, tells him. So it's just really great, you know, this respect with regards to the generations. So Prince talks to his mother, and so here's going back to the story. Prince knew he had a short time at the house and that he could not properly deal with Dada then. His thoughts were to gently instruct Dada just one last time about handling the goats and then go back to the farm. Prince became thirsty, though, so on his way back to talk to Dada, he stopped by the Yaba to get a drink of water. The Yaba was empty. Prince's anger burst into wild fury. He was thirsty, frustrated, and fed up with Dada. At this point, he decided Dada should be taught a clear and final lesson. He intended to beat him, and if Dada died in the act, he would not care. Prince grabbed the closest thing to him, a heavy piece of stick. He started running toward Dada, shouting as he did, "This is it! This is it! I'm going to kill you!" Dada heard the commotion. He jumped up and started to run. What fear does, even to the weak of us. Dada ran away from his father. He was quite ignorant of his direction and didn't care. He just started running with the acute awareness that Prince really wanted to kill him. Dada ran and ran. In his awkwardness, he fell into a deep trench filled with weeds and trash. His weight buried him so that Prince ran by without knowing where Dada had gone. Prince searched, yearning to find and punish Dada. Prince knew that Dada could not have gone far, that he could deal with his son later that day after work. Prince also realized that he had a pressing duties in the field to which he must attend immediately. He decided to leave Dada alone until the evening when he would properly deal with him. Prince returned to his fields. So there's a lot more between this part and the next section that I want to read. So Dada, you know, was saved, you're right. Dada lay on the ground and he started to cry. He mourned and wailed with a fearful voice, his fat body trembling uncontrollably as if wrought with a hot and deathly fever. The children saw what had happened and started to laugh. They laughed at the chubby man who could not take care of his own little gourd, which he had broken, lying on the ground, wallowing in mud, hollering. The children saw Dada almost in a state of helplessness, heaving and puffing as the sounds of his weeping voice changed from fright to anger and then to utter despair. They laughed, and he wailed. The road back to his house seemed longer and lonelier. Dada's heart became sad. It was a heart burdened with feelings of worthlessness, shame, and guilt. He finally reached the house and went directly to Granny's room. She lay there before him, sick and helpless too. She looked at him, and her pity fell on him. Dada didn't know what to do or say. He sat on her bed crying. He cried like a baby. He cried and cried, and as he cried, he started to sing. "Jesus knows all about my troubles. He will help me when the gourd is broke. There is not a friend like the loving Jesus. No, not one. No, not one." And then does he fall asleep? No, he doesn't fall asleep. He starts, as he's singing, Granny starts to hum while he's singing. He walked out of her room singing and feeling better. He felt hope, so his singing got louder and louder. And in the distance, he heard the sound of drums softly at first. And I was wondering if you could talk about the 1st of August. We can maybe close here, commemorating the abolition of slavery in Jamaica. It just sounds like really wonderful, and does that still happen?
Oh, yes. Just make me one correction. It's not the 1st of August. It's 1st of August.
Oh, that's how you say August?
In local, you know, when I was a little boy, everybody said, it's 1st of August, 1st of August. It's really
okay.
The 1st of August. That's when we got liberated from slavery. And it wasn't a gift to us. It was really a struggle that we went through, a tremendous fight. And this hooks back into who you're talking about before your previous thing with Malcolm X. Sorry to take you out of this. But the respect of Malcolm X is that you have to fight for your freedom. Nobody's going to give it to you. But back to the story, we fought for freedom. We finally got it on the 1st of August. And so it became the greatest celebration in Jamaica. today, the entire month, it's a celebration because it combined that with other events. With the 6th of August, which is really when we formally got independence from Britain. So we got liberation from slavery on the 1st, independence on the 6th. So for that week, at least, or for the month, it's a big celebration month.
Mm-hmm.
For August. It was for us.
Yeah, celebration on the 1st and then independence on the 6th. Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. Oh, it's like Juneteenth.
Yeah.
It's a statement
like
Juneteenth. Yeah, mm-hmm. Fourth of August. Okay.
That's great. Yeah, and I'm going to go back to your book and read a little bit more because I stopped before we got to the good part. So as I was saying, you know, Dada, he heard this drumming, and where is it? He's walking home. It's late, and he's supposed to fill the yaba, but the gourd is broken. And let's see, where are we? Gosh, this is a really good section. It's real important too, because this is where he gets that holy water. he's walking home and he hears a strange stumbling sound in the woods. And he looks back, and a young girl about 12 years old stands before him. She's dressed in African robes and holds out a highly decorated gourd to him. Dada stood motionless. He looked away from her and at the fountain for a second or two. When he looked back to see her, she had disappeared, but the beautiful painted gourd remained. What a wonder. Not knowing what to do, but having some sense of the seriousness of his predicament, he walked toward the gourd and took it up. He then ambled to the fountain that flowed out of the rock and filled the gourd with water before beginning his journey home. As Dada began his journey, he started singing again. Jesus knows all about my troubles. He will help me when the gourd is broke. There is not a friend like the loving Jesus. No, not one. No, not one. Dada quickly poured the water from the gourd into the yaba. He poured and poured until finally the gourd became empty. To Dada's great surprise, the large yaba was filled. How could this be? It should have taken about 50 trips with the gourd that size to fill the huge yaba. Magic, he yelled in an amazed excitement. Magic. Lost in wonder with all that had just happened to him, he rushed to see Granny. Dada rushed to her and hugged her. He hugged her more for confirmation that she was real, that things were still real rather than for love. What on earth is happening to me, he thought. The longer Dada held Granny, the better she felt. Dada held her tighter. He did not want her to get away from him like the girl at the pool. He held and she shuffled, and soon she broke free of him. She sat up on the bed and looked at him. Become of you, she asked. Dada's eyes seemed to glow. They radiated a bright blue and red halo surrounding his head. Granny saw it. Dada did not know what to say or do. Granny was the only one who really believed in him, and now she questioned him. They looked at each other for quite a while. Granny finally stood up. I'm feeling good now, she said. Dada tried to hug her again, and Granny pulled back from him, demonstrating her renewed strength. I'm feeling better, she said. I can walk again, and I bet that I can work again, too. Dada went to close the door behind him. Granny, he said, I have a secret to tell you. What is it, Dada, she asked. Look at me, Granny. Sore is gone, head clear, tongue loose. My mouth is filling up with new words, Granny. Just can't wait to say them. He paused, and they looked at each other. She did not know what to say. She knew that she was well. She looked where his sores used to be. They were healed. Only the scars remained. She became silent. I found a gourd that filled the yaba with water, he continued. But we cannot tell anyone. This has to be a secret. His pleading eyes looked at her for help as he gazed back into her ancient eyes. They looked at each other, kindred spirits, with a sincere sense of appreciation for each other. Granny walked with him out of her sick room into the evening light for the first time in many days. She went to the yaba. It was indeed full. The man and the old woman stood there for a while. They looked at each other, then she smiled. Seems like God helps you, she said. It was the girl, he replied. Which girl? Granny asked. Dada told her. He told her about the drums and the music. He told her about the pool and the fountain. He told her about the girl. He told her everything. "Oh, my God," she exclaimed, "they are visiting." "Who is visiting, Granny?" "The opposite people, the loved ones." "The opposite people?" "Uh-huh, son. The ones that you see from time to time." "Oh," exclaimed Dada in amazement. "They come back to visit, especially at this time of year, son." "Granny?" "Uh-huh, Dada. This is the first of..." Uh-oh, I'm not saying it right. How you do it?
First of August.
First of August season. "Son, and you have been touched." Okay, we're going to end there. So, yeah, this book is just phenomenal. It's a masterpiece. And I can hardly wait to read the next section. I got to get that book.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you very much. Yes, and this is talking about transformation. Do you ever become a time in your... Oh, you want to read some more before
I... No, go ahead.
Do you
want to
read...
Next time we have you on, you'll have your glasses and you can read.
I'll surely bring my glasses next time. There surely become a time in your life, on mine and everybody's, when we go through some sort of transformation.
Mm-hmm.
And what, because of the world we're in today, we don't notice them, we don't see them, we don't claim them. So they just vanish, so to speak. But if you look in all the great literature, you know, St. Paul, there's this transformation. There's a time when Jesus went through his transformation. All of these people, there's one moment, you know, Gandhi, King, there's one moment. You're talking about, go back to Malcolm X. There's a moment when he changed from his old name to his new name, a different person. It's completely different. And it's like they cannot be reconciled. So, in Islam, you also have the same thing. This guy who can't read or write creates the greatest bit of literature in the world. So in all of us, there comes this spirit of transformation, and it happened to Dada, and he held on to it. That's a good thing. He recognized, held on to it, and that was his transformative, inner transformative self, and when it's reflected out, he changed his world.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. I was looking at, you know, the section where you talk about Rooster, who is, he's also a spiritual leader, but he, you know, he's on the negative side of the spiritual, I guess, world. You know, he conjures for evil. And the whole thing, you know, around the Dupies, or if that's how you pronounce it, and, you know, the spirits that are walking that can't, you know, they're restless, you know, they haven't had a good death, they haven't been able to resolve, you know, sort of the ending of the physical life and find their space in the spiritual realm. So they're like wandering, trying to get to a place where they can have peace so they can make that transition and transcend. You know,
yes.
Right at the moment, you know, they, you know, when we meet them, they haven't there. And so, you know, Rooster calls them, you know. I mean, they can also be called to the good, but Rooster is calling them to do evil. And then, so I want you to talk a little bit about that in closing, and also about the whole notion of the pig and how Dada and then Brother Walk doesn't like being around swine or pigs, and what that means.
Oh, wow. Well, first of all, duppy, that's a word that came into Jamaican vocabulary, I think, from Taino people. Taino, the original people that lived in Jamaica. They are us today. We interbred with them, and they're us, in a sense. Genetically, we're also Taino. That's a part of the mix that we are in Jamaica. So that's one thing. But another point to make about the 1st of August, and this is more a Kumina concept, talking about the old religion, is that, it's rampant in South Africa, in West Africa also, is that the ancestors don't really die. They go under the earth, and there's a kingdom. Their kingdom is under the earth. So our gods don't come from under the sky, so to speak. Our ancestors are under the earth. And when it's important to us, they come out of the earth they are one with us. So all of the people who perished in slavery, now that we are free people, come out of the earth in the 1st of August and commune with us. And that they were the ones playing the drums that I heard and took him to this mysterious place. So that's part of Jamaican spirituality. And every Jamaican of my generation and earlier believes that to the core, because it's a part of our spirituality. We're connected in a deep way to the ancestors, and we can't live without them. They're us, and we become them for the next next generation. So that's one point to get cleared up there, or two points. The next point, what's the next thing we talk about? The pigs?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Yes. So the concept of duppies, and it's no easy way to talk about this, but they're the ancestors who get a peaceful death, and they go under the earth, and we minister to them. We bring food and stuff like them, and wine and special times. For example, if I knew that Granny's birthday, I would take food and wine to her place of rest and put it there. And spiritually, she would be able to come out and have that meal and partake with us. The food would still be there days after, but it's our belief that she got the essence of the food, the spiritual essence of the food and the wine and the drink, and she would partake of that and be thankful and go back to a resting place. But if we're in danger or something, or if we need to do something important, she would come up and tell us what we need to do in our dreams, or appear to us as a spirit, or as you say, a duppy or something like that. So they're not dead. They're alive in a different way, in a different realm. So, but there are other spirits, and this has gone into another religion, African religion called Obia, and it's also a spiritual religion. But what it is, the way it comes to us in Jamaica, it's a manipulative thing. One aspect of it is manipulative. In other words, it can be very good and beautiful and helpful, but one aspect of it is that you use that powerful gift in a negative way. In other words, you use the power or the magic of the underworld. You can challenge it to do whatever you want. In other words, you become like a god. You're manipulative, or you're manipulating or using your power incorrectly. And that's Rooster. He's doing all of that for money. That, I guess, the same source of energy and spirit, but he uses it to help people. So in other words, you can another way to look at it, in our community, you can have the gift from the gods to be a scientist, and you can use it to create good medicine, or you can use it to create an atom bomb. It's the same kind of a thing. But so Rooster is the guy who just saw personal gain from his spiritual power. Just use it for wealth. He didn't understand that there is a good, that he could be like that. Just lost, in other words.
Mm-hmm. Wow. It's been, you know, such a wonderful, we had such a great time talking to you this morning, Beresford McLean, about your writing life, specifically Broken Gourds, but about, you know, these other books that you've written, your second novel, Providence Pond, which is available at AnansiBooks.com in an e-book, or on Amazon if people want a physical copy. And we're looking forward to your third novel, a novel, Fishhook River, which is coming out spring next year. And certainly, like, you know, I'm going to let people know, you know, where they can see your play first, know when it's produced, hopefully later on this year. Yeah, and then you got so many other works that are just coming through you. So, yeah, definitely going to have you on again, and looking forward to, meeting you.
We're not too far from each other, just in Oakland. And
yeah.
I'm hoping to get First Snow done in New York and also in Oakland, in the Bay Area.
Good. Excellent. Oh, that'll be
excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's been really lovely having you on. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you. I like your mind. It's very rich.
All right. Well, you take good care and continue, great work. you know, you walk and you write. That's what you do now. So, yeah, so want to wish you, you know, more perfect strides.
That's very, very, very nice. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Peace and blessings.
Bye.
Bye. So we're going to close the show with Mama C out of Tanzania, and she's got a piece called from Hug a Thug, The Malcolm X Factor.
She has an affinity for brothers who survived adversity, came through with a spine made of steel. You know the kind, the brothers for real. Some would call him a thug, but he's the one she loves to hug.
But I call it the Malcolm X Factor. That Malcolm X Factor in my man. That is a factor, you know. That thing in a man, a black man, and a weird man, a panther man, my man.
She loves to hug. Such. She loves to hug. She loves to hug. Thug. She loves to hug. Thug. Walking in the boardroom, Trojan horse in a Brooks Brothers suit. He needs no gun, signs of black and white, and walks out with all the boots. Laughing on the elevator on the way down. Wondering, do they know thugs bearing gifts make a whole different sound?
That Malcolm X factor, you know, that thing in a man that can make him have the heart, the nerve, the courage to go from pimping to concern for human rights, from a love of diamonds to laying pipe in the middle of an African village.
She loves to hug. 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 Quietly handling his business, the spook who's sitting by the door. He's got you covered and will readily go to war. She won't sell him out to keep her Versace gown. They're on the same page, and plus, for him, she down.
Yeah, sure, yeah, that love of diamonds and pretty things and long silk socks might still be there, but hey, not as a goal. Just as a sure enough honest appreciation. And that love of service and commitment ain't going nowhere either. From rustling up food for Kansas City school children to serving as a bedrock example of tenacity and imagination to African youth.
Loves to hug. She loves to hug. She loves to hug. She loves to hug. The prerequisite is to neither be handsome or cute. Just be conscious of your cosmic mission, mentally agile, intuitively astute. Remember what Pop told Kadada when death was coming round? Can I go? Nah, stay here, baby. Something's up. I feel something's going down. Like a dog smelling a bitch in heat when trouble in the air gently pulls her out of her nirvana dream, because sometimes femininity can be totally unaware.
And that Malcolm X kind of laying on of hands and spirit and politically correct love. Hands that Malcolm might have had for Betty, Betty Shabazz, but I can't confess to knowing about that. That Malcolm X factor in my man, it's more than evident in my man, my husband, my love, my comrade, MJ Peter, Felix, Pete O'Neill.
That was Mama C, Malcolm X Factor. Want to remind people that the 4th annual San Francisco Green Film Festival is May 29th through June 4th, and opening night is at Thursday, May 29th, 6 p.m. Is the reception at the Aquarium of the Bay, and then at 8 o'clock is a screening of Damnation, directed by Ben Knight and Travis Rommel. And that's going to be in the Bay Theater, and I'm sure there's going to probably be a party after that. And then we had on the air directors of a couple of films that are screening as a part of the film festival, and one of the films is that we had the directors on is Come Hell or High Water, The Battle for Turkey Creek, which is having a San Francisco premiere Saturday, May 31st, 7 p.m. at the, let's see, where is the film screening? at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco. I believe that's on Valencia. And I'm looking for The Great Flood. That's another film we have the director on speaking about. And that is, oh my gosh, that is such a phenomenal film. It's just really, really beautiful. And that's going to be screening on Sunday, June 1st at the Little Roxy. And that's at 7 p.m. Bill Morrison directed this wonderful work. It's having a San Francisco premiere. And there are just these really wonderful films that are a part of this 4th annual Green Film Festival, May 29th through June 4th. So you want to go to sfgreenfilmfestival.org to find out about all the great films and workshops. And the theme this particular festival season is looking at the water here on the West Coast, California specifically, because, you know, we're having some water issues, and Damnation looks at that, how waterways are interrupted and drained, and communities are left without water when these man-made systems come in to disrupt the natural flow of things, so to speak. I wanted to also remind people that Chasing Measurely by Shanaka Hodge, with Intersection Campo Santo and the Living Word Project and Youth Speaks, they've added a couple of shows, which is really great for those of us who missed it, but they're not going to be at Intersection. They're going to actually be at Z-Space Studios, which is they're located at 450 Florida Street in San Francisco, so May 29th through the 31st, 8 p.m., and you can get tickets online. And then there's a special free performance for youth, 14 and up, on Friday, May 30th, 1 p.m. at Z-Space. So you want to go online and check that out. And if you go to, how did I find this? ChasingMeasurely.brownpapertickets.com, you can find the information about the added performances. All righty. And anything else? I think that might be about it. So looking forward to connecting with everyone again on another edition of Wanda's Picks on Friday, 8 o'clock. Peace and blessings.